The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
Hi, I'm Richard Shankman, the director of The Man from Earth, and you're in The Projection Booth with Mike and Justin.
What if a man from the Upper Paleolithic survived until the present day?
You know what could happen? Yeah, the pancreas turns over cells every 24 hours, the stomach lining, in 3 days, the entire body. In 7 years, but the process falters. Now, if a quirk in his immune system led to perfect detox, perfect renewal, then yeah, he could duck decay.
We were just talking about a caveman who survives until the present time.
And he hasn't aged a day in 10 years. Every woman on the faculty would give anything to have that secret.
I don't have eyes in the back of my head. I can't hear flea walking. I am not in any way Superman.
There have always been legends of such a thing, a creature, not quite human, taking not the blood, but the life force itself.
God has spoken through man to make his word clearer.
You got four men of science completely baffled, my friend. Who do you think I am?
You are absolutely certifiable.
You stand alive and tall in a graveyard that you helped to fill? Well, then perhaps it's time to die.
Welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me as always is Mondo Justin.
Hello!
This week we're getting out of the 70s, 80s, and 90s and bringing you something much more recent, 2007's The Man from Earth. So, Justin, this week was all you, bud. Why the choice to cover something so contemporary this week?
There was really no plan to go, you know, more recent. It's just I sort of stumbled on this film doing some research for an interview a few months back, and, you know, I was just so blown away by this film that I really wanted to make an attempt to hopefully, you know, turn some people on to it who might be out there listening to our show.
Nice. That is always the goal of the projection booth, isn't it?
That is the plan.
The Man from Earth is the story of John Oldman, a college professor who's leaving home. At a going away to get together, he reveals to his colleagues that he's actually a millennia-old caveman who may have been better known as Jesus H. Christ. So begins a captivating, intimate, philosophical meditation on mortality, science, and faith.
Yes, and let's note that the film was written by the legendary television sci-fi writer Jerome Bixby. Sometimes the film is known as Jerome Bixby's The Man from Earth. You know, Bixby was the man, you know, behind many of the fan favorite episodes of such television shows as The Twilight Zone and
Star Trek the original series.
Right. And the classic sci-fi films, It, A Terror from Outer Space, and Fantastic Voyage as well. You know, a little later on, we'll be playing back a couple interviews I did with the director of The Man from Earth, Richard Shankman, and then Emerson Bixby, producer of the film and son of Jerome Bixby.
And no relation to Bill Bixby, from what I understand. So what's the truth regarding what I've read about this film, that Jerome Bixby wrote the film on his deathbed?
Right, and don't get Emerson Bixby mad because he will change green.
Pants start ripping.
That's right, eyes turn green. Yeah, but yeah, you know, more or less, the deathbed thing, you know, Jerome Bixby actually passed away prior to the film starting production. Emerson sat with Jerome, in his final days in the hospital, and then at home transcribing into script form this idea that, his dad had so many years prior. So, but, you know, before we get into that, I don't want to talk about too much because we're going to hear in the interview a little bit later on.
Oh, my bad.
So, you know, this was the first time, I think, you've seen this film. So, you know, what did you think? Yay or nay?
You know, I watched it a couple times. The first time, I was a little cold on it, and then I watched it again today, and I enjoyed it a lot more the second time. I think I had a real problem the first time with the way that it was shot. It's very much a stage play, and it feels very, very stagey.
You know, you can argue that, but also, you know, you need to think about, you know, it does work. It would work as a stage play. It also work as, you know, a brilliant episode of television. You also need to take consideration that more or less this is a sci-fi sort of equivalent of 12 Angry Men. You know?
Yeah, I can see that. So, yeah, I can definitely see that.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say you have a problem with I actually think the direction and how it's shot is one of its highlights, actually. That, you know, it's so beautiful. And if the camera is so patient, and camera's always sort of roving, and you're getting these sort of just almost impossible to catch close-ups. And I think the direction helps make the film very intimate and powerful.
Well, I won't say the direction of what you actually see on screen, but I'll say the direction of the actors, because there are a few clunky lines where I wish that they had had another take to go with or something, just because I have problems sometimes, and this might just be a personal thing, with stage acting happening on screen, because there's just this kind of different way that people are speaking. It's like they're speaking to the back row, and they're not as subtle as they can be when they're on screen. You know, it's that whole, like, when people made the transition from one medium to the other, sometimes they don't necessarily act the right way. You know, they're not thinking about close-ups and the little movements of their eyes versus waving their hands around. And there's no hand waving in this film. There are just a few lines where it's just like, God, this sounds right out of a stage production, where it was that very stilted delivery. And which is a shame too, because it was from one of the actors who I usually admire. I mean, I will say, like, it's got a tremendous cast. William Catt is in it, and Tony Todd, and they're both terrific, and I have no complaints about them. But it was the guy, and I'm blanking on his name right now, but he's the guy who came up with the jump to conclusions board from Office Space. He gave a couple clunkers in there, and I was just like, that's a little too stagey, but he eventually kind of redeems himself in the film. So that's why when I watched it again the second time, I guess I knew it was coming, and I was able to prepare myself for a little bit more and enjoy it a little bit more today.
All right, well, we'll have to agree to disagree, I guess. So, you know, what do you think about the concept? I mean, I feel this is a really interesting concept, you know, more interesting than most. I mean, does this concept work for you in the sense that you have these people just in this one room for 90 minutes telling a story? Now, is that something you have problems with, or can you work with that? Or, I mean, you know, are you able to sit still in that one room for the 90 minutes?
I'm definitely able to sit through that. And there are some films that are more geared towards that, say like a Death Trap or something, where you feel like, okay, these people are stuck in this room. And obviously Death Trap was a stage play at one point, but I'm trying to think of other films that you could say it was created for the screen, but you can see it working on stage very well. I guess some people would say like Reservoir Dogs is something where you've got these people in a room and they're, you know, hashing it out for basically 90 minutes. In that one, you kind of cheat a little bit because you get to go outside during the flashbacks and everything. And there are some outside pieces in The Man from Earth as well. Very limited, of course, you know, and definitely nothing like, you know, no William Catt running down the street away from cops or anything. But I have no problems with watching people delivering some really solid dialogue, and especially because the concept behind this film is so fascinating to me that it's like, okay. And I bought into it, and I was along for the ride, and I like the different beats, you know, how they take you through the story and you switch it up a couple different times. And yeah, I thought that it worked for me.
One thing I've really, really appreciated about The Man from Earth is just the way it's written, in the sense that you could have these people in the room, you know, hashing it out, as you say, you know, or arguing that this cannot possibly be true. But what I like about it so much is the fact that these people are all educated people, and they want to believe the story. Do you know what I'm saying? They're trying to debunk it. They've never said that, come on, I mean, this is not true. And maybe a few times when it possibly hits too close to home for them in their own personal lives, but they do spend the majority of the time wanting to believe this story. And I think that is just brilliant.
Well, I think that they handle it very well too, where it's like, okay, Sam writing a science fiction story is like how he really leads into it, you know? And it's like, okay. And yeah, they're willing to play this parlor game of what if, and then it kind of goes along and goes along and goes along. And then it's like, oh, and by the way, I'm that guy. You know, it's like, oh, okay, so you've got people buying into it. So yeah, I think that the pacing of the storytelling is very, very key to enjoying this film, and the way that they present the information, I think, is very, very well done.
It's so clever, and you really get that sense. And I think it's kind of silly that we're sitting here babbling on about this when you gave a little synopsis, but in case people are looking for a broader picture, what this film is about a guy who's leaving town after 10 years, and he's sitting around telling his very good friends that not only is he 10,000 years old or maybe more, but he may be Jesus Christ. This is actually hard for them to swallow, and really affects each of them on a personal level. And they spend the whole film just grilling him, asking him about his past and his memory and history and geography and what he remembers, and, you know, if he's had children. And so, I mean, it's just a really, well-executed, beautifully written film. It's an amazing concept as well, and it's something that you've never seen before.
It could have gone wrong so many times. Really, the key that leads you in is people seeing this painting by Van Gogh, and I was immediately reminded of Doctor Who. And Doctor Who is this, you know, character who travels through time, of course, and is always seems to be there for these big historical events, you know, just happens to be along for the ride. When I saw the Van Gogh, I was immediately reminded of this horrible, horrible episode of Doctor Who. Like, for the last, I guess, season and a half, it has just gone to absolute crap. And the episode I always point to is this Van Gogh episode. So when I saw that, I was like, oh no, is this going to be, because I kind of knew what the concept was going in. And then when he mentioned a few people and places and stuff that, you know, like he almost went with Columbus and those kind of things, it's like, oh no, was he like in all of these key things, you know? Well, then I happened to look up and there was the Hindenburg exploding, oh my gosh, or, you know, and then when the comet landed and it killed the dinosaurs, you know, I was like, oh no, this guy's going to be around for everything. I was there when Vesuvius blew up, but luckily they avoid that. And then that, the whole religious angle to it, I think they worked on very, very smartly. I really thought that they did a good job with that because it wasn't too far out. And it kind of played into something that I've always held, that a lot of the teachings of Jesus were very similar to what Buddha had said before. And we all know that, you know, so many of these concepts of Christianity are just rehashed ideas from other older religions. So I thought that they handled that very well.
Sure, it weaves in and out of there just enough to where it's convincing and it's not silly. It's a very forward-thinking film in the sense that it is questioning faith and science and immortality, and it appeals to me on that level, you know, and I can see why this film may be quote-unquote blasphemous for some, because it is essentially denouncing everything that has been programmed into people's heads, you know, in the essence of religion for years and years. So it's a brilliant look into the writing of Jerome Bixby in the sense that this man was a very educated man and he really studied everything. And frankly, what I find so interesting about the film is the fact that he did write this at the end of his life. And so you have to ask yourself, like, were these questions that maybe he was asking himself as his life is diminishing before him every day? And that's the most fascinating part about this story to me, is this really just one man's quest for the truth, one man's thoughts put on paper for the world. That, I mean, can you imagine, like, what goes through your mind if you know that you're going to be passing away soon? It must be very, very intense, and you must have a lot of questions.
What I found kind of fascinating was reading about this guy, and yeah, he was very, very learned on stuff. Going back and watching the old Star Trek episode, Requiem for Methuselah, where it's almost like a dry run a little bit. You know, there are some of those ideas are in there, but they handle it so much better in The Man from Earth, because it's one of those third season Star Trek episodes, original series, which not a lot of people like the third season of that. The writing was a little bit weaker, and they really forced Kirk and his romance stuff into this episode, and it's like, oh, why couldn't you just handle it a little bit better? So it's neat that he was playing with these ideas all the way back in the 60s, and that they still were sticking with him all the way up to when he finally put them all together into something that I think is much more of a well thought out piece.
It's a very important subject matter, I think. It really sticks with you, and it's really interesting. I've seen the film, I don't know, probably 10 times now, and every time I finish that movie, I cannot leave where I'm sitting. I sit there and I begin to ponder and I find myself at peace. And it's really interesting to me, these concepts. And, you know, I can certainly buy into these concepts without any problem, because on a much simpler level, these are questions I've had myself. And I think a lot of people have had these questions themselves over their lifetime too. You know, not that I'm old or anything, but I certainly am not one to be a man of religion. And I know you're not either. So, I mean, in terms of on that level, what are some of your thoughts on that level, in the sense that can a person be spiritual but not religious? I mean, is there good and bad religion? I mean, you know, I know that you are a quote-unquote atheist yourself.
No need to put that in quotes.
Essentially, atheism is a religion unto itself. What is the difference for you between spirituality and religion?
Well, I guess spirituality for me, the idea of belief, which I find very admirable in people when they can believe in like any kind of higher power or order to the universe. Well, I guess even then, you know, spirituality can be separated out even from that. Religion to me is much more the organization of things, the rules, the rituals, the texts, all that kind of stuff. I'm actually very, very fascinated by religion, and I have been for years, but I come at it from much more of an anthropological point of view, I suppose, where it's like, I find it very interesting how things happen in the past in order to have them happen today. You know, it's like the way that religion has, or Christianity, well, even Judaism and stuff, has shaped our language and some of the concepts that were in the Bible that have come into our speech. I am always trying to get my hands on different books that explain, say, how what gospels were chosen and why they were put in the order that they're put in. I will admit I was having a little bit of a problem with the character in the movie who was just so offended by John telling the story. And, you know, as soon as he got into the Jesus stuff, and she would just, you know, wanted to shut down completely. But I know that those people exist. And so it's true to life, but those are the kind of people that I really can't stand.
But on that same note, how can you criticize her? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, yes, she is that kind of person, but she's still just a person, you know? And what he's saying to her is literally rocking her world. Like, it is destroying everything that she has ever known to be fact. And so I can see how she has that response, because it's got to be sort of mind-blowing, you know, that everything you've been taught or everything you've learned or want to believe in is possibly not true. And, you know, they beat upon that very heavily in the film, that anything is possible.
Well, I guess I just have a hard time with folks that believe the Bible literally. You know, it's like, really? You know, you really think that? You know, so those are the folks that I have issues with. It was interesting for me to see one of these people portrayed and just be like, you know, your mind is getting blown by this, because it was basically, to me, like a different interpretation of things. So I was like, okay, yeah, I can kind of see that. You know, there was a great book by Christopher Moore that was out a few years ago called Lamb, the Gospel According to Jesus's Boyhood Pal Biff. And that one was fascinating to me, kind of fell along the same lines, where this kid, Jesus, grows up in Nazareth, and then he goes out to the East and learns all these different spiritual things. And, you know, he doesn't study with the Buddha, but it was along those lines. He does, you know, become a monk, and he, you know, learns about all these different types of Eastern religions. You know, I don't know if he goes as far as Japan with Shintoism and stuff, but he learns about Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism and all this kind of stuff. And then he comes back with all those different teachings in order to spread the word. And when I was watching Man from Earth, I was like, great minds think alike. Yeah, that is very, because what he was teaching was very similar to what the Buddha had taught.
Yeah, and then also on that note too, you know, they talk about, you know, the King James Bible being a revisionist ideal. And yet again, this theory is very revisionist as well too.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it sort of ties in well with that, you know. We should move on forward a little bit and talk some more about the acting in the film, because it's very important for me to tell people that this film features Tony Todd. You have to be living on Mars to not know who Tony Todd is, you know. If you're a horror fan, you certainly know who Tony Todd is. And then if, you know, maybe you might remember from Tony Todd from The Rock or in The Crow. And he's here, and it's so great to see him in this role. It's so outside of the box. It's so un-Tony Todd. Do you know what?
Right.
I really appreciate his performance in this movie to no end.
Well, he's got that great sonorous voice, and it was just so nice to hear. And then it's funny that, you know, he was in all these different Star Trek, you know, incarnations. I think he's been in every Star Trek other than the original series, and then kind of tying that into this whole sci-fi universe of Bixby and stuff, which I think is great. But yeah, Tony Todd was a standout. But I will say, no one gave a weak performance. You know, I criticized the one actor for like a couple clunky lines, and I wish that there had just been different coverage for that, from the most name actor all the way down to, I won't say, like, you know, girl number three or whatever, because what's nice is that it's a nice small ensemble cast, and everybody is really bringing their game to this.
It's very intimate, and you know, with the acting and the casting of the film, for me, you know, this movie would be nothing without David Lee Smith as John Oldman. He really is the star of the show, and, you know, quite honestly, you could probably have cast anyone anyone in those other roles and it would have worked just fine. But David Lee Smith is the person who puts this thing all together, and he's so damn believable that you want to believe him. You want to believe in the story. It's so important, you know, that role is done correctly. Otherwise, this doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, I think the guy who didn't bring his A game was Moving Man number 2. Yeah, he really...
Yes, he sucked. He did suck,
he
right?
He was awful. Yeah, I didn't buy him at all.
Going back to what you said about Tony Todd and the Star Trek, because that's actually a bit of the joke in the film, is that the entire cast was actually featured in Star Trek at one point.
Oh,
especially John Billingsley. You know, he was the the goofy crackpot, Johnny Walker green-loving biologist. He was a pretty big Star Trek actor.
Wow.
And yeah, they were all in Star Trek, and that's kind of a bit, you know, and there's some great jokes layered throughout the film about sci-fi. And, you know, one of the greatest lines is at the end of the film when Tony Todd walks out of the house and he says, I'm going to go home and watch some Star Trek because I really need a dose of reality. So it's a really great line, yeah. And then David Lee Smith, I can't talk enough about him. You know, it's like this guy's, you know, went on to do TV. I think he did some CSI stuff. And it's like, God, what happened to David Lee Smith? Like, why didn't he do some bigger films? He's just so amazing in this movie. It's just so wonderful. And, you know, I guess because we have so much more to cover, let's just get into it right now. We're going to skip ahead and we're going to play back the interview I did with Emerson Bixby about writing the film with his dad. So, you know, right off the bat, I got to ask, like, what was your dad's inspiration for Man from Earth?
My dad was inspired to write Man from Earth when he was in New York in 1946 and came up with an idea of somebody who was a civilized man who had been born a Cro-Magnon thousands and thousands of years ago. And so the idea kicked around my dad's head since he was 23. In fact, way back in, I guess it was the 40s or 50s, maybe it's the 50s, my dad saw a young actor in a movie, called a guy named Charles Bronson, some guy my dad had never heard of before, and he said, this guy should play the caveman because he's a small guy, but he looks really fierce, really intense. And so for like 10, 15 years, my dad thought, if I ever write my movie, that's who I want to play the caveman. Because Bronson was a small guy and Cro-Magnon were pretty small. But he was stocky, he was strong, he had this really intense face.
Sure, especially think about what he looks like in House of Wax.
Yeah, well, I think the movie my dad saw was Machine Gun Kelly. It was some old Corman movie. It was probably Machine Gun Kelly. But the idea was kicking around my dad's head for years and years and years. And then he did Star Trek. And so 23 years after Dad came up with the idea, he finally put it in an episode of Star Trek. But it was always just, always kept digging at him that he wanted to do that story of a caveman. And so he just finally went back to it. Like literally, he started the script about maybe, I guess about a month and a half before he passed away. And it was almost done with it. Then he was in the hospital from a quadruple bypass and finished it literally on his deathbed. On his last 2 days before my dad passed away, he was dictating to me and I was writing him on like, hospital napkins. You know those stupid little things they give you at hospitals, stupid pajamas that don't cover the back?
Sure.
I stole some of those, and I'm writing on it all over the place, making notes and writing down dialogue and stuff. And up to 2 days before he died, he was dictating scenes.
You know, what do you think it was about this idea that stuck in your dad's head, you know, to finally where he decided to write it?
A movie my dad always loved was 12 Angry Men. And that's a good example of how, you know, I mean, that was Sidney Lumet. I think it was his first film. And how good dialogue and a good idea can carry a story. And he wanted to do a thinking person science fiction. And there were times he'd wanted to do that before. I mean, way back in 1975, 76, I think it was 76, my dad wanted to do a movie called Elsewhere. He wanted to do an intelligent story about mankind's first encounter with aliens, and it was called Elsewhere, and it was real cool. It was from the total film was from the aliens' point of view as they're coming to Earth, and at the end they land, and we have this peaceful encounter. Then he finds out that Spielberg is doing it. He's like, Dad's like, damn, this sounds like a good movie. He was hoping it would be like, you know, crap, so he'd still be able to do it. But he saw the movie, and there were very few times my dad went to theaters and watched movies. That was one of them, to watch Close Encounters. It blew him away. And it's like he just totally, you know, forgot about his, because it's like, you know, after Close Encounters, you know, anybody would be an idiot to do a, you know, an encounter movie. That happened once or twice, you know, he'd want to do something and somebody would, you know, happen to me a few times. But Man from Earth, that always just kept scratching around his head, an intelligent science fiction movie that is totally dialogue and ideas, not explosions and special effects. I mean, movies recently have just gone into the toilet. The last, 25 years of movies is just, it's pathetic.
So, one thing that I wanted to see about Man from Earth 2 is, how much research does your dad or do you guys put in, to the script in the sense of with all the facts and the myths? Like, how much did it take you to put that together?
Well, my dad knew a lot of it already. My dad was a reader. My dad had, literally probably 3 18-wheelers filled with books. I mean, my dad had a lot of books. He read everything. He was really smart. He just knew everything about everything, except probably rap music, because, rap sucks. That's one thing he probably didn't know nothing about. No, seriously, when I die and go to hell, they're going to make me listen to rap and drink decaffeinated. It's going to suck. But so a lot of the stuff my dad already knew. I knew a little bit, there was a guy named Mises, so many years before Moses, it was the same story, and, Hercules and Jesus. I knew some of that stuff, but my dad just had, buckets of knowledge. And there were a few things that I'm sure he researched.
As you're sitting there and, you're transcribing and making notes and stuff with your dad, inches away, is there a bigger range of emotions for you? How do you handle, doing this when your dad is so close to leaving you?
I thought he was going to live. I was totally in denial. Even when he passed away, I didn't believe it. I did not, believe it. But I thought he was going to be okay. But no, I remember just being real, real blown away by it. I was really, I remember throwing in my, at one point he wanted John to drive away and not pick her up. He wanted him to just drive away and end it with him leaving and her. I'm like, no, he's got to come back. He's got to come back. He's got to, the car stops and he turns around, and he starts to drive back. We see her walking to meet him. And my dad was against that for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes. And I'm like, come on, come on, come on. He's like, write it both ways. We'll look at it. And so I brought him a couple pages the next day. He's like, okay, yeah, you got it. Okay, yeah. There were a few things. There were one or two things that we took out of the movie. There was one character two characters that were similar, and most of the dialogue we gave to, we edited the character and gave most of his dialogue to Billingsley, who was similar to the character. And because these two characters, it's like they were both really good characters, but they were almost like the same guy. They were both very down to earth and kind of just laid back and let's just go with it and see what happens, And I thought to myself, when I read the first draft, I loved everything except one scene, one character there was just one scene that I thought, no, because this will tell us where he's going. And I don't want the audience to know that. I want the audience to have no clue where this guy's going to end up. But I was very adamant to see it done as Dad had written it. At one point, I was offered $280,000, $206,000, a lot of money. But they wanted to have flashbacks and explosions and show a flashback of John, on the sailing with Columbus. And at one point, this producer tells me, and I'm not joking, I'm not making this up, what about a flashback? I'm doing his voice wrong. Okay, Emerson, what about a flashback? Show John leading the whole army of cavemen. And they got a whole army of mastodons or something. And the bad guys, the Wagaboos or whatever, they got a whole army of velociraptors. And so there's a gigantic war that the velociraptors that are being ridden on by the Neanderthals. I'm like, dude, it's Neanderthal. And they didn't quite ride velociraptors. And, dude, seriously. where do we start? What part of you're an idiot? I told the guy his parents should use protection, and I cussed the guy out, which maybe wasn't smart because this guy was an A-list producer. And
wow. So, was your dad religious?
No.
Okay. So do you think that because of because of all the commentary on contemporary on the Christianity in the film, do you think, was this some sort of statement with him? Maybe because he was so close to leaving, you think that this was an issue of faith and mythos, in terms of religion for him? Do you think maybe?
No.
You don't think so?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. No, he just wanted to tell the story. I mean, I'm sure realistically, I mean, at one point somebody read the script and they said, you can't do that with a religion. I'm like, well, then don't make the movie, you know, shit. But no, Dad was not religious.
So with that, you know, with the Star Trek joke at the end, you know, Tony Todd says, did your dad have a pretty good sense of humor about him?
Yeah. Actually, the line originally was, I think originally it was Simpsons. I think originally in Dad's script it was, I'm going to go home and watch Simpsons for a dose of reality. And then I changed it to Buffy because I just liked Buffy and I figured Buffy was cooler than Simpsons. And then it ended up becoming Star Trek, which was really fitting because, you know, Dad worked on Star Trek and Tony and a lot of the other people. I mean, there must have been like 5 people involved with the movie who had, you know, been in Star Trek in one way or another. John Billingsley and David Lee Smith, a lot of the people on the film had been in one way or another associated with Trek. But no, I think Dad would have liked the film. I think, in fact, I did some interview with somebody, I don't remember who the hell it was, but I would personally put it, you know, right there between Mirror, Mirror and the original version of It's a Good Life as, you know, one of the 3 best produced things that he's done.
You know, working so close with, you know, this concept and the script, and didn't you at one time want to direct this yourself?
Yes.
And
yeah, I got tired of people saying we got to throw in special effects and explosions and naked chicks and crap like that. And I just figured, screw it. You know, I'm going to make the movie myself. And I was really, really, you know, I was happy when Richard called because he was the only person who even remotely got the script. Everybody else was an idiot. And I was mildly annoyed. I remember telling my wife, I'm like, damn it, I want to do this stupid. Oh, well, hell with it. This guy's, let's him do it. Because, you know, I've only directed 1 friggin' movie, and this guy had done like 5 or 6. And again, you know, he got it. He really knew what he wanted, and he didn't want to change it. He wanted to do this script as it was written, and that's, you know. So, my dad were alive, you know, he would be very pleased with it.
Yeah, so if you would have went forward with it on your own as the director, did you have any kind of notion set in place where you had in your head that you already knew like how it was going to be cast? Like, who did you see casting it if you were going to direct it?
Oh, I had no idea who I would have cast. I wouldn't have had the money to. Of course, we did it with almost no money anyway. But I was just, I never reached the part of casting. Actually, wait a minute. There was one actor I remember thinking. I forget his friggin' name. I forget this. Damn, it's going to drive me nuts. I remember. I wanted, if I'd gotten my way, I would have wanted Catherine Mary Stewart to play Sandy, although I think, you know, I don't know if, you know, I haven't seen her in anything recently, but I always liked this actress. She's beautiful but not skanky, you know, really attractive, but no, really, she was pretty,
yeah.
But she wasn't annoying.
Well, yeah,
she wasn't
like Night of the Comet and...
Exactly, Night of the Comet, yeah.
The Gold Mine, yeah.
Yeah.
So, cool.
And, yeah, I always thought she was pretty. I always liked her. And, there was one actor, I'm trying to remember who the hell he was, that my dad had in mind for John. It's going to drive me crazy now. I don't remember who the hell it was. It's going to friggin' drive me crazy.
So you and your dad had already talked about maybe who was going to who you guys wanted to cast in this film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Dad had some very specific... I remember at one point Dad wanted... Max. Actually, it's funny. Dad wanted Max von Sydow to play Gruber. And then, you know, after Dad passed away, they got... Shankman was talking about von Sydow. And although truth be told, I'm real happy with Richard Greeley. I thought he was great.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I thought he was really, really good.
You know, so my last question, I think, is a kind of a two-parter. So, you know, what do you want people to take from The Man from Earth that see it? And what do you think your dad would have wanted people to take from The Man from Earth when they seen it?
Well, I think my dad would just, for the most part, just want them to think, walk out the door and think about stuff, you know? Whether it's, you know, the origin of the wheel or the origin of, you know, this belief or that belief. Don't get me wrong. My dad doesn't in any way really believe that, you know. Although there's a lot of the stuff that Jesus taught, a lot of it was the same exact thing that the Buddha had taught 500 years earlier. And my dad believed, I believe, that you know, Jesus had heard about this. And, you know, I mean, Buddha's teachings, you know, has survived. And Jesus is like, wow, that's really cool. Let's just, you know, pass that shit on. And so I'm sure that's what he tried to do. I'm not religious. I'm not religious, but I believe Jesus was a real person. he died a really horrible death. I think he deserved a better movie than that stupid Mel Gibson film. It should have been called The Jesus Chainsaw Massacre. It was just this poor guy getting his ass kicked for 2 hours. It's like there was only two scenes. One scene where Mary the Hooker and Mary the Virgin are wiping up a bunch of blood, and one scene where he's making an entertainment center and talking to his mom, and that had any emotion. Aside from that, it was like this basically just watching this poor guy get his ass kicked for 2 hours. And the Romans, I mean, they played that movie like the Jews were more evil than the Romans. It's like, dude.
Okay, we're back. And Justin, I just found out why I don't know John Billingsley from Adam, is that he was in Star Trek Enterprise, and I kind of couldn't watch that one.
That was your favorite incarnation of the series.
Oh, no. Anything but Enterprise. I mean, even Voyager was more palatable than Enterprise was, and I wasn't a big Voyager fan.
Nice. Was Scott Bakula in Enterprise, or was he in Voyager?
He was in Enterprise.
Okay, I don't mind that one, actually, because I like Scott Bakula.
Yeah, well, I wanted to like him, but just couldn't do it for me. But no, even Kate Melgrew was the Voyager lady, and even though they really tried to screw it up in that first season, it actually managed to become a halfway decent show by the end of its run.
Yeah, you know, going back into it before the next interview, again, I want to touch a little bit on the direction of the film, because I do think it's very well done. I'm in love with this camera, and this guy really knows how to create an intimate feeling. And then also you've got this totally out of left field shot where, you know, John Oldman takes the gun from Dr. Gruber, and you've got that really interesting shot of Oldman pointing the gun at the camera, looking through the, you know, the empty chambers. It's such a great shot.
Yeah, I was very surprised, because I think it was Chekhov who said something about if there was a gun introduced in the first act, it damn well had better go off by the third act. And so I was just like, okay, how are they going to do this? And then when he showed that there were no bullets in the gun, I was like, I wonder if that just undid the whole Chekhov thing. Chekhov, another character from Star Trek.
That's
right.
Right
there. Yes.
And I guess you could argue that there was a gun that went off. It just wasn't an actual gun in terms of how the film ends.
Right.
This is why I make the big bucks.
I like it.
Anyways, the score of the film, I think, is just really great. The score is very subtle, and it's done by Mark Hintzeuer, and the themes of the music change if you listen closely while you're in the story. You know, when he's talking about a cave being a caveman, you hear some sort of primal music, and then it switches to something else, and then it gets like, you know, as he gets older, starts talking about later years, you hear some Beethoven. And so it's just really well done. It's a very, very effective score.
Yeah, when I watched it the second time today, I was watching it at a place I shouldn't have necessarily been watching this film, so I wasn't able to watch it
like
so
in
much
the back seat of a Volkswagen,
something like that, and I wasn't able to watch it so much just listen to it. And so I did really pick up on that musical stuff that you're saying, and listening to this film, it would be a great radio play as well, because you really do pick up, you know, it's the performances are so much of the film. And the thing I like about the direction of this is that it's not so much in your face, doesn't draw attention to itself on purpose. This is not an over-directed film, where it could be. You could be very tempted as a director to be like, I've got these people in this room, I damn well better spice up this story and start giving you weird angles and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, really Brian Singering it up, you know, doing a little The Usual Suspects kind of thing and over-directing. Nope, we kept it calm, kept it smooth, and kept it interesting.
Yeah, the story is obviously the most important thing, and there is some Shankman there. And I guess, you know, my thing has always been, like, as a director, you either need to put yourself into it, or you need to be completely invisible. And Shankman is sort of invisible here, and except that there are these really clever shots, you know, there's that scene where you know, John Oldman is standing with his back turned by the door, and in the background you see you know, all the people sitting and staring at him as they're talking about him, but he's not in the conversation. It's almost like, you know, he's left the room. So I mean, there is some flavor there, you know, which I think is really well done. And I think Shankman's a really great director, and it's a really well directed film. I know some of the people have criticized online that there is a lack of cinematic appeal to it, you know, because it is in one room. And you look at something like 12 Angry Men, which I know influenced Shankman in terms of shooting the film, and I think both 12 Angry Men and The Man from Earth work on the same level, and they're both done very similar, and so the story does come out to the front, and I think that's the most important thing. Otherwise, you have a Richard Shankman movie and you don't have The Man from Earth, and the direction is very invisible here, and I think that's very important, and it works for me.
I mean, in a few weeks we're going to be talking about Kurosawa's High and Low. In the first half of that film, is very stage play-y. And I think that there are some similarities too. And you don't get that feeling that you're trapped on stage because of the way that the framing is done. And it is so cinematic. And I think that the two films are similar in that way. And same thing with 12 Angry Men. The only part of 12 Angry Men that always makes me jump is that close-up of the old man's face. And it's like every time there's one shot in the movie where it's just like, bah! You know? But otherwise, I do love the way that film is shot. And that's one of those where I can watch that any day of the week. And sometimes I've been known to do that because it is a great film.
Let's talk about the twist, quote unquote, of the film. I don't know if you want to bring this up, but I know in previous discussions you and I have had off mic and via email that the twist wasn't something you got at the first point, was it?
Was not something that I got right there. So
when you went back, did you see it though?
I did see it in the second time, but okay. I won't try to defend myself. I just missed it the first time around, and you know, feel a little chastened by that. So
you could probably argue that it wasn't done as well as it could have. You know, it's maybe sort of like it was trying to cheat the audience a little bit by not making it a little bit more blatant.
Hey, you know, but if again, I wasn't drinking so heavily, maybe I would have picked it up the first time. Okay?
If you hadn't watched The Man from Earth after drinking a whole fifth of Johnny Walker Green,
exactly,
you totally got a twist.
And, nothing and but just the best.
Right, and for people listening, we're not going to give away the twist. I really want people to go out and check this film out.
Yes. So that John Oldman is actually a woman does not matter.
That's right. Yes, and actually, it's all been a dream. Oh, yes.
No. Oh, they're actually in purgatory this whole time.
That's right. Right. With the themes of the film and what it's asking the audience to question, and over the years, there have been other films that have come out that have taken a similar approach in terms of questioning faith and science and religion. You know, there's films I can think of right off the bat, like Bergman's The Seventh Seal, you know, Hal Hartley's The Book of Life, Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ, and then, you know, there's this sort of movie that sort of drifts out there in cinematic purgatory, in my opinion, which is called Mind Walk, which has Sam Waterston and Liv Ullmann in it. And so, I mean, have you seen that film? And then I know there's some that you want to mention as well, too, right?
I have not seen that film. Just looking at the description, I was like, man, this could be kind of slow. And then I think you said to me that it was kind of slow. So it's like, I'm not really rushing out to see it. But I don't know. Do you recommend that I check that one out?
No.
Okay.
Not really.
Okay.
People that have seen Mind Walk, you know what I'm talking about. There are some out there that are like, oh, yes, it is a brilliant film.
Okay.
And it's a really long movie of three people having dinner. Think My Dinner with Andre, but about religion and faith and physics and literature and Sam Waterston and Liv Ullmann. They all work for me. I guess you have to be in a certain frame of mind to check them out. And then, you know, a film like Seventh Seal and Book of Life and then, of course, Last Temptation, you know, they're very cinematic.
Mm-hmm.
So this film isn't, and Mind Walk really isn't. So, and then didn't you want to make, I know we talked a little earlier, didn't you want to make mention of Highlander as well?
Yeah, you know, of course I kept thinking of Highlander through this movie. That's the kind of twisted mind that I have. I was thinking of Highlander and just, you know, the whole immortality, and they do speak in that one about, you know, Connor McCloud's former wives and just, you know, how you have to give up love as you go throughout the ages if you're immortal and other people aren't. And I found it interesting too, at one point in Man from Earth, he makes mention of a guy who he ran into who seemed like he was different, like he was. And so I was like, oh, okay, you know, that's kind of cool. You know, it's not like they're running around chopping each other's heads off in order to get the prize, in order to forget about it in the sequel and stuff. But, you know, I found that interesting. And I know you brought up Seventh Seal, but I was actually reminded of The Seventh Sign while I was watching this because of the whole Carter Phyllis, the guy who is cursed and has to wander the earth, because that ties into Christianity as well as the immortality kind of thing, which that kind of got me onto this whole thing where I was reading about the whole wandering Jew myth. And that was very interesting, just all the different variations of that myth. And it always leads to somebody being cursed either by God or by Jesus and then having to walk the earth until the second coming. But sometimes it's like, oh yeah, well, it was Longinus, the guy who stabbed Jesus. And oh no, it was a shoemaker. Or oh no, it was this the guy who wouldn't let Jesus rest and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. So of course I was reminded of that while I was watching the film too. So, and of course there was Zelig, who always seems to show up at historic events too. So, you know, could have, he's almost the Doctor Who of narrative films.
And then how does the seventh sign, how does Jorgen Prochnow tie into all of this?
Well, Duke Leto Atreides has the signet ring.
Yeah, I want to mention something about this film. There is sort of a tragedy that happens here in the sense that this film, you know, it did play in a few theaters very shortly, you know, maybe like one-off theaters, and then it got a DVD release, but it has yet to find its audience on television. It has never played on television. You would think a film like this would play on a sci-fi channel or something late at night. It just, it hasn't, you know, and you know, to get the word out, because people have found it and saw it and liked it, have started spreading the word. And, you know, there's very famously a site that had BitTorrents on it where the filmmakers, one of the producers, actually went on and sort of, you know, tongue-in-cheekly thanked the bootleggers for pirating his movie because it would get the word out. So it's a pretty daring move. But I think in a film like this is important because it does show you what you can make with very little money, you know, and why aren't we getting more of these films out there like that? And why aren't films like this being seen on television instead of Dino Croc versus Super Gator?
Because there's no Tiffany in it, and there's no Deborah Gibson, and there's no Crocosaurus in it. So it's sad that something that's very thoughtful, and this should be playing, if not sci-fi, it should at least be playing on like the Lifetime channel or something, where it's very fascinating, great acting, good character study, and, you know, yeah, I think more folks should see it.
So you're telling me, since Richard Shankman and Emerson Bixby are probably listening, that if they had cast Tiffany or Paul Hogan, this movie would be on the Sci-Fi channel?
I think so. I mean, they should probably market it as starring the greatest American hero, William Catt, in Jerome Bixby's The Man from Earth. It's a lot to put on a poster. With that, here's the interview Justin did with the director of The Man from Earth, Richard Shankman.
So, you know, starting right off the bat, you know, how did you get involved with this project?
Well, that's funny. I just, you know, I guess I've told the story a few times. What happened was back in 1999, I guess, or it was either 98 or 99, probably was about 6 months after Jerome Bixby died. A friend of mine called me up, a friend of mine who's a producer whom I'd worked with once or twice, called me up and said that a guy he knew was producing a movie and they were looking for a director. So I got the script and I loved it. And so I went to a meeting, and at the meeting was my friend, this other producer guy, and Emerson. And the other producer guy was basically Emerson's manager, and he was trying to position himself as a producer. And I told them what I loved about the script. I told them, honestly, the few things that I thought needed to change. And everybody seemed all excited and seemed like, you know, we were all in agreement that we could make the movie inexpensively, and we'd run around trying to get it started. And I was very pleased. And then I didn't hear anything for a while. And I finally tried to look into it, and it turned out that the other producer guy, seeing my enthusiasm, figured that meant that other people would be just as enthusiastic and they could probably get a bigger director on board. So he encouraged Emerson to not keep in touch with me and that they were going to get themselves a bigger, better director to make the film. But over the course of a few years, they tried and they were never able to do it because people either wanted to do a total rewrite or they wanted to add lots of flashbacks and action sequences or they wanted to just have this part of the story be basically the first act and then our guy's on the run from the CIA who want a sample of his blood or something like that. And Emerson, in attempting to honor his father's work and memory, turned that down continually. So years went by, and then back in so about 5 years later or so, 6 years later, a friend of mine made a movie that he shot on mini DV for $110,000. And it was good. You know, he had shot it in a couple of weeks here in Los Angeles, and it looked like a movie. And I was talking to my friend Eric Wilkinson, and we should do that. You know, we should make a movie for no money. And the problem is nothing I'd written was appropriate. And he said, well, have you ever come across any material that you thought you could do for that kind of money? I said, you know, there was this one script. There was basically eight people in a room talking. I said, that I could do for the money. And so somehow he managed to track down Emerson and get his number. I called Emerson and I said, you know, I don't know if you remember me, but I was circling your dad's final script. And he said, remember you? You were the only director who ever wanted to make the movie the way he wrote it. You know, I wasn't allowed to talk to you and you know, da, da, da. So I said, look, I don't have any money. I'm going to make the thing for no money at all, but I promise to make it the way your dad wrote it. And he said, I'm in. And that was how I got it.
What, you know, reading that script for the first time, what is it about it other than, you know, the simplicity of the filmmaking? What is it about that story that attracts you to it?
Well, the simplicity of the filmmaking came later on. That was when the decision, when I made the decision to make a low-budget movie by hook or by crook, and then it was a question of what material works for that. No. When I first read the script, there was not an intention to make it at that budget level. It just connected with me. I thematically connected with it entirely. A lot of the same things that I've spent time thinking about and I've spent time feeling were addressed in the script. I love the heady science fiction of it. And of course, I just love the writing. It's a beautifully written script. The characters are well drawn. The dialogue is deeply intelligent, and I found it to be, even though it seemed to be mostly intellectual exercise, I loved how emotional it was.
And then, you know, for people that haven't heard the commentary, you know, it's, in terms of your casting, how did you, I mean, were these people that you had set out intentionally to get, like, did you always have Tony Todd in mind? Like, how did you come about casting the film with who you have?
No, I didn't have anybody in mind when I began the project. It really was like casting most movies, where you figure out what your budget is, you figure out basically when you want to shoot it, and then you go, and then you start figuring out who are the best people that you can get, either because they are going to be physically available at that time, or because they are willing to do this kind of project, or because they fall in love with the material as you did, and then you go out to them and you hope that they like it, and if they come on board, then you build your cast. In our case, I knew from a marketing perspective that it would make sense to get ourselves as well established in science fiction a cast as we could, and even more so to get people who had Star Trek cred, and it was great. Tony, I guess, was the first really name actor to sign on, and it was great because he had been in every version of Star Trek except the original series, and he obviously has a very big name in the science fiction fantasy community, and so that gave us some credibility. And I went after John Billingsley, and he actually helped me get to Ellen Crawford and Richard Reilly. John knew them and was a help in getting those actors on board.
And then someone like William Catt, with that method of thinking, was probably pretty obvious then.
Well, yeah, not obvious. But what happened was, you go out into the... One of the ways you cast a film is you put out what's called a breakdown. I think Bill's manager was one of the people who submitted a bunch of names after seeing the breakdown. And when I said Bill's name, I thought, oh, there's a great idea. And then we go back to her and we say, yeah, we'd like to talk to Bill. And she said, oh, he's not available for this. And I said, why'd you give us his name? And she couldn't exactly remember why he had given us his name. But I was able to get to him directly somehow. And to be honest with you, I don't remember how I was able to get to him directly. But I was able to get to him directly, and he thought it was terrific. And so he signed on basically over his manager's objections.
I can't imagine that you did any sort of – I mean, did you go into that, you know, highly prepared in the sense that you maybe storyboard some sections of the script? Like, in particular, I'm just kind of dumbfounded in terms of your direction. You have like this amazing, like, subtle direction going on in it, where the camera's moving slowly and very, you know, sort of ominous. And like, I guess in particular, I'm just talking about like that great shot you put in there of when John is looking through the barrel of the empty gun. So how did you, I mean, did you storyboard some of that stuff going in?
No, I didn't storyboard. I generally don't storyboard unless it's either a special effects sequence or you're going to be working with other people. Other people are going to go have to, I don't want to say second unit. I've never really had a second unit, but I didn't storyboard this film. What I did was I rehearsed for a week. I rehearsed 5 days in a, just in a rehearsal space, and then one day on set. And the idea of the rehearsing the one day on set was that we'd be able to start breaking down, we'd be able to start blocking the scenes so people would know roughly where they were going to stand and sit and cross. And then with that knowledge, we'd be able to plot out some of our camera angles and our lighting. That worked out okay, not quite as well as I'd hoped, just because well, whatever. It helped a bit. Probably a second day of blocking would have been a big help, but it just didn't have it. You know, so it was 6 days of basically rehearse and prep the thing, and then what was going to be 7 days and turned into 8 days to actually shoot it.
Can you talk a little bit about you know, what's been written on the internet in terms of, you know, the distribution of the film, in the sense that, you know, you guys actually thanked bootleggers for ripping the film and sending it out to people?
Yeah, that was, I mean, well, part of when Eric quote unquote thanked people for stealing the film, that was obviously tongue-in-cheek. He wasn't thanking them for stealing the film. What he was thanking them for was for watching the film, loving the film, telling their friends about the film, going on IMDb and giving us a 10 out of 10, and basically spreading the word about the movie. That's what he was thanking them for. I mean, he wasn't thanking them for stealing the film, especially the people who lived in America and really could have been or should have been buying the DVD or renting the DVD or digitally downloading it or something along those lines. I have a lot more understanding of the people who lived outside of the country and had heard about the film and were anxious to see it, who didn't have any legitimate means of getting their hands on it. What are you going to do? If I knew then what I know now, we would have distributed the movie in an entirely different way. We would have distributed the movie in a very web-centric way. You know, I would have created a site where people could stream the movie basically for free and then pay a small fee and download a high-res version, maybe even using BitTorrent technology. And then if people with American ISPs would have tried to do that, they would have been redirected, you know, to Amazon or iTunes or someplace like that. But I didn't know. You know, I did not know the movie was going to become an international phenomenon.
Why hasn't Man from Earth reached a bigger audience yet? Like, why haven't we seen it, like, play on Sci-Fi?
Well, Sci-Fi, obviously, was the first place we tried.
Mm-hmm.
I had a very nice conversation with the acquisitions guy from Sci-Fi, who enjoyed the film very much personally. And he basically said he had no place to put it, that their schedule did not allow for a movie like this. He said that the only original movies they acquire are basically action movies. And because the film has no action, there's no spot for it on Sci-Fi. I said, can't you put it on at, you know, midnight on a Wednesday or something like that? And he said no. Yeah, I don't understand it. I mean, a movie that people respond to this way. But, you know, we went to all the usual suspects, you know, IFC and Sundance and all the places you would think might air a film like this, especially a film with the kind of numbers we got at IMDb and the awards we won and the reviews we got. And they just said it doesn't suit their parameters.
And then, so is there any chance or any knocking around of a sequel?
Yes, there's a whole story beat out for a sequel. That I was very proud of, but I have not written the script on spec because it's going to be a big job, and I don't really want to write the script until I know that we're going to have the money to actually make the film. I've been very surprised. I've been very surprised that, for example, the company that put out the original DVD, who sold well over 100,000 units, that they wouldn't step up and fund a sequel. It wasn't like I was looking for that much money. But they have not responded.
The real question is, as the director of this film and some of the themes and questions it poses, do you yourself believe in God?
Me personally? Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. You know, sometimes I answer the question, sometimes I don't. I don't think it's relevant. Let me answer the question like this. The movie in no way denies the existence of God. In fact, my feeling is, if God exists, and if God was going to have a man to speak on his behalf on earth and call that man his son, in a sense, you know, we all would be God's sons, but, you know, that this one would be metaphorically called God, wouldn't this be the way he would do it? You know, wouldn't this be a great way of doing it, to create a miraculous man who can wander the earth for, you know, 12,000 years gathering knowledge, gathering wisdom and experience before he finally steps up and says, I have a thing or two to say. I have a few ideas that might help people. Wouldn't that be a way to do it? What I find interesting is the people who get angry and say that the movie is, you know, either anti-Christ or anti-Christian or anti-Jesus or anti-God, I don't think it is at all. I don't think it is at all. I mean, I think the people who, I mean, how many times has the Bible changed, been rewritten, reinterpreted over the years? To literally interpret any one version of the Bible is kind of silly. I think you've got to take a broader view of all of the Gospels that have been written by all kinds of different people, some of which are accepted as the official part of the canon and some aren't. But, and then you're going to have to go back to the original Aramaic, I think, to make a real judgment. You know, who among us speaks Aramaic? And then how do you account for all the different versions? You know, the eye of a needle, you know, there's so much. And even then, we have to assume that the original Gospels were, to even if they were basically true, they were written so long after the fact that to a degree they were apocryphal, or at least full of metaphor. Who knows anything?
My last question for you is, you know, what do you want people to take from this movie, you know, after they've seen it? Like, what should, you know, obviously it's got a lot of messages and so what do you think people should take from this movie after they've seen it?
Well, it's not really my place to say. I mean, maybe if this were my first film, I might have something to say about that. But something that I learned a long time ago is once the movie's done, it's simply not yours anymore. It's the audience's, and they're going to react to it however they will. They're going to love it. They're going to hate it. They're going to have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I learned this when my first movie, The Pompadour of Love, came out, and I got two different reviews in the New York papers. And one of them was the kind of rave that was so effusive, it was almost like my mom wrote it. That was from the New York Times. And then there were other reviews, like in the Village Voice, who just hated the film. And I just thought, okay, well, then there's simply no accounting for what anybody is going to take from a movie. All you can do is fill it up with as much heart and intelligence and honesty and, you know, as many ideas as you can, and hope that people get something out of it.
The ugly bruise of fear is swollen and festering.
A claw-fingered, scaly-skinned, half-human crustacean.
The black hole of despair. The clenched fist of doubt.
A frenzied bedlam of blood-curdling horror.
What if things were really getting better?
Hold on, folks. We're expressed to the top floor.
The Vertical Pandemonium Audio Theater. Only on mentalradio.net.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Hey, this is William Katt. And you're in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
Raise your right hand and repeat after me.
The spook who sat by the door. The controversial best-selling novel now becomes a shocking screen reality. The story of the first black agent in the CIA.
Whoever they select will be the best known spy since 007.
Their first mistake was letting him in.
And let me congratulate you on being the first Negro officer in the Central Intelligence Agency.
Their worst mistake was letting him out.
Really want to mess with Lanny? I can show you.
For 5 years, he was their token Negro.
Freeman, you people must serve.
For 5 years, he kept his cool.
Man, you just don't belong. I think you'd be happier with a mop in your hands.
Like your mama.
And in return, they taught him how to spy. How to fight. How to kill. For 5 years, he was the spook who sat by the door. And then... He turned gangs of ghetto kids into a highly trained guerrilla army.
We live off the land. We match technology with spontaneity and improvisation. Men against machines, brains against computers. Now, if you don't think it can work, you check out Algeria, Kenya, Korea, and Iran. Can you dig it?
He turned a summer riot into a revolution.
This is not about hate white folks. It's about loving freedom enough to die or kill for it if necessary.
He turned the American dream into a nightmare. Yesterday, a novel. Today, a movie. The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
And Mayor's office is now air conditioned, courtesy of the Black Freedom Fighters of Chicago.
That was the audio for next week's pick, the 1973 Ivan Dixon directed The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
So, final thoughts on The Man from Earth?
Well, final thoughts on the film. I was a little taken aback when I first started watching this, and when it ended up being what it was, I almost emailed you and said, what are you making me watch? Why are you making me watch this? And that was probably about maybe the 20-minute mark. By the time I got to the 30-minute mark, I was sold. I was in. I was watching. And I had to leave at one point and then come back. And as soon as I got back, I put on the rest because I wanted to see more of this film. And I, you know, it's like I said before, it's got a great structure to it. And the way that they reveal information is very well done. I think the writing is terrific. And I don't know if that's all Jerome Bixby or if that's Emerson Bixby, but somebody named Bixby, maybe it was Bill, came in there and did a terrific job of the way that they do that and the pacing of the direction. I think the editing also needs to be really noted in this, and I think that they did a great job of keeping the action going for what could be a talk fest, but you know, it keeps you riveted.
Agreed. If you get through 10 minutes of it, you'll be hooked and you'll revisit it time and time again. It's a very important movie, I think, and it's definitely one that needs to be checked out right away.
And what's nice too is that it's on the, at least at the moment, it's on the Netflix Instant, so I was able to watch it wherever nice. I was traveling and was able to pop that on and watch it on the road, which was great.
That's awesome. So if you're listening, Netflix Instant, go today, now.
Now, do it. So that's all the time we've got this week. Be sure to leave us some feedback and a rating on iTunes.
You can go to the, you can get the show on your mobile phone with Stitcher, and you can download and listen to the show over at Jackalope Radio.
With a replay on Jackalope Radio, Sunday nights at 6 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Eastern.
For more information, please visit our official website at www.projection-booth.com. And for more on The Man from Earth, please visit the film's official site at manfromearth.com. Buy the soundtrack on Amazon and the DVD.
All right, beam me up.